Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I am Christina, your host for today, and we're very happy to have you listening along to the Beer Ladies podcast. Quick order of business before we get into it. Just a reminder to check us out on YouTube and please subscribe and follow us. Find us wherever you can get your podcasts. And we thank you very much for your support so far and hope you're enjoying the show. So in normal fashion, we're going to kick off today's episode with the perennial question, what are you drinking? So Erica, can you tell us a little bit about your beverage of choice today?
Yeah. So I have Whiplash beer, which was brewed and packaged at my place of employment. It's called the Quad of Paradise and it's a Belgian quadruple. And I'm just showing the camera some of the beautiful artwork. Kind of looks like pink sort of umbrellas that are flowers coming out of black stems, and it's a 440 can and it's coming in at 11.1%, but I'm on the late shift tomorrow, so I'm gonna allow myself this treat.
And Morella, a little early where you are, so might not be having beer today, huh?
Yeah, it's not too early for beer. It's 11. That being said, I'm not having beer right now. I'm drinking some hot water just to stay hydrated. And it's funny, as I'm getting, you have a beer too, Christina.
Oh yes. I'm drinking the Double New England IPA from Porterhouse. This is part of the Manaw Collective collaboration. So it's women artists who have designed and done art for all the cans, which I just think is really cool. This says Never Have I Ever. And there's a collection of a couple of them. And I just think they're really cool. And this is 8%. So it's a lot for a school night. So I will be drinking this quite slowly.
It's funny because I'm just reminded my mentor, Lorenzo, who's a lambic Italian craft beer expert, often talks about, because you know we judge in beer competitions, but there are people who judge water competitions, right? So, and he calls them les buveurs tristes, which is the sad drinkers. And that's how I'm feeling right now watching the two of you drink beer while I have my hot water.
So I want to just briefly introduce our listeners to our guest today. So our guest today is Morella Amato, and she is beerology. And we're just really excited to have her on the show and talk about her new course and a little bit about her background in beer. So I just want to kind of kick off today with asking a little bit of what got you interested in beer? How did you, what started your journey?
I had a really unusual experience, I think, from, you know, certainly an unusual experience for someone of my time, which is that I was introduced to craft beer first. So as soon as I started drinking, I was out at the pubs drinking cask conditioned amber ales mostly. And this is due to the fact that my drinking buddy at the time was, I imagine maybe in Europe, it's a different experience. But in North America, it's an unusual experience. My drinking buddy at the time had spent a lot of time in England and so was really drawn to these more flavorful beers. So my passion really was sparked when I hung out with other people and saw them drinking the same beer by the pitcher all night when there were all these cool flavors to explore. And so I became that really annoying friend who was always dragging people out to the fancy pubs to get the fancy beers. And I think my excitement was even, or my passion grew even deeper when I realized that I could just drive over brewery and talk to who made this beer mm-hmm. and find out what that's all about. So, you know, that whole local aspect was also really exciting to me. So that's how it started. And, you know, at the time, craft beer was not a thing the way it is now. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, there were those of us who were really hardcore into it. And then most people didn't even really realize it existed. So back in the day, I was fond of saying, you know, when I retire, I'll write a book about craft beer to get people to, you know, understand this beverage a little bit better. And, you know, as things transpired, I ended up being able to work in beer before I retired and also write that book before I retired. So it worked out very nicely for me.
And what's that book called, Mirella?
Oh, it's called Beerology, Everything You Need to Know to Enjoy Beer Even More.
Well, congratulations on that. Being an author is a really big deal and something you must be very proud of.
I am very much proud of the book, and it's won some awards, which is fun, and also been translated into French, which I assisted with, and into German. And, you know, the goal with my book is to help sort of untangle a lot of the information with beer and with craft beer. As I'm sure you both know, beer gets very technical, very fast. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the early literature on craft beer and a lot of the early anything about craft beer was rooted in home brewing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the way, certainly at the time and still today in many cases, that people explain beer is really from a homebrew perspective and includes all kinds of information that you need if you want to brew a beer, but not so much if you just want to drink and enjoy mm-hmm. it. So my book was really about focus. I always, and all of my work now focuses on, you know, what's in the glass and what do I need to know to really love and appreciate this beer in front of me and maybe enjoy it even more through food pairing or through, you know, the proper glassware, et cetera. But, you know, not necessarily leaving out the details that aren't required unless you're planning to brew a beer or, you know, or judge a beer, which is again, a different kettle of fish.
Mm-hmm. And just, I would like to ask you actually about sort of some of those technical things, because you are a master cicerone and a beer sommelier and you have advanced brewing certificates and a national level BJCP beer judge. So if you want to talk to our listeners and explain a little bit about what being a cicerone is, or the difference maybe between being a cicerone, a sommelier and a beer judge, if there are great differences or not, and how you found your experiences sort of getting those qualifications.
Sure. So maybe I'll do them in order that they were received. So the first thing I did when I got into beer was get into the BJCP. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure any of the books that are out there now, there were very few books available. And the BJCP is an organization that categorizes and defines different styles. So what is the difference between a Czech Pilsner and a German Pilsner, for example? Or what is the difference between an English style IPA and an American style IPA? And it gets really into the details. And this is, again, started by home brewers, very important. And so since I wanted to become an expert in beer, a logical first step for me was to understand the nuances between the styles. So mm-hmm. what I did is I went through the guidelines, and I would drink a beer while reading the guidelines and try to make sense of it. And then eventually start just drinking beers and take notes on those beers and then compare them to the guidelines until, you know, those two things converge. And I really felt that I had isolated those styles, and simultaneously I was on a crusade to taste every single style in the BJCP. And I think to this day, there's only one that I have not had. And when I say I haven't had it, I'm talking about Kirsch. And when I say I haven't had Kirsch, I haven't had it in Köln. So I don't consider that I fully understand that style, because although I've had many, many examples, including German brewed examples from Köln, until I have it there, I feel like I haven't quite checked that box. Anyway, so at the time, that was a huge written exam followed by a tasting exam. It's different now. Now I think the entry level is just a multiple choice online. And the way you move up the ranks in the BJCP is by getting better and better grades and judging experience, which I love. I love the way the program, because I firmly believe expertise is a combination of knowledge and experience, and that's really how they play it. And so I was very lucky in that I got a national level grade the first time I took the exam, which is at 80%. Or above. So then all I had to do was over, and it took me a couple of years, build enough points to get to that national level. So that's been wonderful. I remain a beer judge to this day. I judge in international beer competitions at the World Beer Cup and the Brussels Beer Challenge and the European Beer Star. Not so much with COVID, sadly, but hope to get back this year. And I find it continues to be like a wonderful, wonderful place to learn about beer, because there's no greater way to really keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on and really what's out there than judging blind, you know, drinking blind. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge advocate of blind beer tastings. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to keep going?
Oh,
I just feel like I've been talking and talking.
I had a couple of questions.
Yes.
So do you think you're a super taster? Is this something that comes naturally, or can it be taught, or is it kind of a balance of both?
That's a question I get often. And I don't know if I'm a super taster. I have done, there's a test that you do with this little bittering strip that apparently some people taste it very strongly immediately, and some people can't taste it. And that sort of entry-level test about super tasting. And I certainly can taste that very strongly. But, you know, I don't know if that means anything at the end of the day, except for, you know, that I can perceive that particular compound. You know, I haven't done any extensive tests about super tasting. I think that the truth is there's two pieces to tasting and evaluating. And from what I have seen, and I've conducted a lot of guided beer tastings in my day, a lot. Most people are better tasters than they think they are. And if they're just relaxed and not thinking about it, I will often hear people just give amazing bang on descriptors. And the real skill that needs to be developed, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of becoming a better taster, is not becoming better at tasting things, but becoming better at figuring out what it is that you are tasting, take it from your mouth, process it through your brain, and then come out with the descriptor, right? Because how many times have you tasted or smelled something like, oh, that's familiar, but you can't put your finger on it? So the training really lies in making that connection and getting the connection to be as speedy as possible, and doing what you can to strengthen that connection. I think that is the more challenging piece. More so than, you know, being a taster or super taster or whatnot. Sure.
And I think the power of persuasion can be very strong if you're influenced by hearing what other people think they might see or smell or taste. So I think it's important to maybe be a bit private about it initially and write it down and then compare later. So you're not just agreeing.
Well, yeah. And that, like, I remember when I was doing my BJCP certification, and what exactly like you're saying, Mirella, like the big learning curve for me was the vocabulary, was learning, like, I know that this is what this is, but what is the word for this? How can I explain this to someone else? What is this? Very, very kindly, we did a course, and you know, they were pulling out beetroots and being like, this is earthy, smell this, this is what we mean. put the things together, but it was so valuable to be able to kind of, exactly like you're saying, harvest that vocabulary, which is really quite a skill to get. So I would completely.
And it just takes practice. And constant practice, right? If you stop doing it for a couple of months, you'll start slipping again. So,
it's, and I'm sure if someone has COVID and they've lost their smell and taste, that can potentially have knock-on effects as well.
It's been a big fear of mine for this whole, because my whole work revolves around sensory. So, so far so good. Oof.
And do you teach like the off flavors? Do you spike something and then explain like why this would be bad or why it might be desirable in certain situations?
I did for many years. So my work with beerology has really always been about driving the industry forward. Mm-hmm. And the way that I've sort of shaped and evolved the work that I do with beerology has really been about always looking around and seeing what might be missing in the industry, you know, what is needed, and then sort of comparing that with my skill set and figuring out, you know, the best fit. So a number of years ago, probably almost 10 years ago, I looked around and realized that there was no one offering off flavor tastings. This is before the Cicerone program created their little kits that you can now buy online and go train yourself at home. It really was not a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I created a 3-day off flavor course, and I offered it in English here in Ontario and in Ottawa, as well as in French in Montreal. And I did that for a number of years, and I had home brewers, but a lot of professional brewers also in those classes. And it was a very, very, I mean, off flavors are fun, right?
Yeah.
It's fun to do.
Yeah.
So I did that for a number of years. I had to stop at one point. I had some little health issues. And I think once COVID is over, I'll probably revive that. Although I probably will revamp it, because again, the Cicerone program now has those off flavor kits for anyone who's looking for like an entry level off flavor course. Mm-hmm. So if I do start offering off flavor courses again, I think they'll be more specifically geared towards professional brewers and fully utilizing all of the brewing certificates that I've completed to help them out.
Sure. And what would you recommend that someone do in order to get up to an intermediate level to take some of your classes? Like, are there things that they can be reading or listening to in the meantime?
I'm not sure I followed your question.
I think I read on your website that your courses are designed for people who are already at an intermediate level with the sensory training.
Right.
So like how?
Okay. Yes, I understand. There?
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. So what you're referring to specifically, I think, is my new beer and food pairing course, Mastering Beer and Food Pairing, brought to you by Beerology. And I put that disclaimer there because I looked around when I was creating my beer and food pairing course and noticed that most beer and food pairing resources that were out there were 90%. This is what beer is, and these are what malt flavors are, and these are what hop flavors are, and this is the difference between a stout and a pale ale. And then there was, you know, a short chapter at the end on how to actually pair beer with food. And so what I wanted to do is create that end piece, that beer and food pairing piece. And so anyone who's taking my beer and food pairing course, I call it intermediate. I don't know if intermediate is the right word, but anyone taking the course should already know what beer is and be comfortable with beer style. So should know what a porter is versus an alt beer versus a pale ale, because I just assume when I'm going through the course or when people are going through the course, I'll just say blah, 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 porter, blah, 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 blah. And I won't stop and say porter, which is a dark ale, but you know, like I don't. Yeah. So that's assumed. And the other thing is, because this is an online course and I can't physically be there, sadly. I rely on each student having their own confidence in terms of beer tasting. So if in the course I say, you know, whatever beer is in front of you, you need to be able to tell me if it's has a high bitterness or low bitterness. The person taking the course has to be able to confidently say, okay, this is a high bitterness, because I can't, I'm not there to,
right,
to confirm that. So those are the two pieces, tasting beer and beer styles. And the course really was designed for anyone who works around beer. And I firmly believe that anyone who does already has those skills. Mm-hmm. So I'm not very concerned. For anyone who's looking to develop those skills, I can't believe I didn't come up with this myself, but it was recently pointed out to me that my book would be a great resource. bad self-promotion, bad freelancer. Yeah, my book is a great resource. I would just say, get out there and try as many different styles as you can. There are a number of, you can go my route and go with the BJCP, which is pretty intense. There's the Cicerone program, who has the certified beer server, which is their first level. And that's a course you can take online. I think it's called Beer Savvy. So that's something you can go ahead and do. But I find most people who are passionate about beer already have that skill set. That's why maybe intermediate is a bit of a strong word, but I couldn't figure out what else to say there. And I just wanted to make sure that no one was going in knowing zero about beer, mm-hmm, and very excited about beer and food pairing. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm talking about alt beer and they're like, what's happening? I mean, I guess they could pause the lesson and look it up, but I feel like that would be a bit of an overwhelming experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So actually, can you talk to us a little bit more about your course? I was watching your YouTube video introduction about it, that talks about how it's in sections with each lesson, with different lessons. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk to us a little bit more about specifically about the course.
For sure. So the course is online. It's entirely, you can take it anywhere, anytime, which I understand has its own challenges. So I did put, there is a section I just added recently with tips on how to maximize online learning to help people with that format. Because, you know, it's very convenient to be able to take something whenever you want. But it's also very that, like, there's no accountability. Mm-hmm. So for example, in this chapter, I have like a proposed calendar that you can like download and use to actually schedule your studies and that sort of thing.
That's helpful.
Yeah. I found it necessary after talking to, getting feedback from a few people. Sure. So the course is online and you can complete it from anywhere with any beers. So, there is no, like, you must find a bottle of this specific beer, the course, or anything like that. And that's, you know, one of my bones to pick with beer literature and beer materials in general is they lean heavily on specific beers that not everyone has access to.
Yeah.
And I wanted anyone anywhere in the world to be able to, you know, obviously at this stage, understanding English is required, although as soon as I can, I'll make it available in French as well, and we'll see. Mm-hmm. So from there, the course is divided into five sections, and sections include just little short video lessons. I think the longest one is 15 minutes, maybe, and most of them are around the 5 to 10 minute mark. And it takes you through everything you need to know to pair beer and food. And my approach is very, and it has always been very practical. So a lot of the information out there on how to pair beer with food is, here's a bunch of rules. There you go. Good luck. Or here's a bunch of things that pair well together. Here's a list of beers and foods that work well together. And both of those approaches are useful. Of course, you can learn a lot from, that's how I learned to pair beer with food. But it's not the same as a step-to-step, this is how you do it. You know, mm-hmm, here you have a food in front of you. This is step one. This is step two. This is step three to get to your beer, or that you have a beer in front of you. Here are the steps. Mm-hmm. So the five sections of the course, the first one is beer and food traits. And that's required, even though people entering the course are expected to understand how to taste beer. I thought it was important to take a moment to really break down, since matching beer and food is about finding qualities in the beer, traits in the beer that go well with the traits in the food. The first step is being able to identify the relevant traits in the beer and the relevant traits in the food. So the first section is all about that. And it has, you know, I think a lot of things that people will already know, like the difference between taste and flavor. I think a lot of people are familiar with, and talking about intensity, but I do go a little bit deeper, and there might be like some surprising details in there. And then the second section is actually how to do it. So pairing basics. So that's all your rules. But I do break it down in a bit of a more approachable fashion. And in terms of all the pairing interactions, I have weeded out all the ones that are really not that important and focused on the ones that you really need to be able to pair beer with food. And then section three is pairings and practice. So that's like, okay, now you know your rules. We know how to identify traits in beer, how to identify traits in food. Now this is the step-by-step. It's the how-to. So once you get past the section three, you are completely able to pair beer with food. That's really all you need. Section three also has some additional tidbits that I think some people will find more useful than others, but there's a section on planning a whole meal, right? So what are the, it's one thing to pair one beer with one food, but what if you have three courses? Like, what are the additional considerations? What are the other things you have to think about? And then the last section is even more specialized, but because it's something that I have a lot of experience in and I wanted to share, I put it in there. And, you know, the people who do find it useful find it incredibly useful. And added how to host a beer dinner, like logistically, step by step, like how do you do that? So, you know, not everyone who takes the course is planning to host a beer dinner, and that's fine. I've had a few people tell me they also thought it would be useful just for at home. You know, little details like when do you pull the beers out of the fridge? How do you make sure the beers are the right temperature? That kind of thing is the more universal. It doesn't necessarily require, you know, a public tasting. So those are the first three sections. Section four is advanced techniques. So this course is really designed for someone at any level, as long as they know their styles and their tasting. So I would imagine someone who's really new to beer and food pairing would do sections one, two, and three, and then take a few months to just practice and grow before going into section four. And you have a full year to complete the course. So it's really, there's no pressure to just get it all done. But someone who is more advanced, I've had a number of advanced Cicerones, for example, take the course, and they've just gone right through, and they have found a lot of very useful information in the advanced techniques. Interestingly, they also found useful information before, because again, anyone who started around the time that I started, or I would say most people in beer and food pairing, have like read some rules and read some pairings, sort of developed an instinctive way to pair beer and food. And so what my course does is it helps you understand, like, and this was my journey too, was, okay, this is instinctive to me, but what am I actually doing? What is going on in my brain? And so I've gotten a lot of feedback about how useful that is, the more sort of deliberate approach and deliberate understanding of what is going on. I'm on a huge tangent. So number four is advanced techniques, and number five is presentation. So just how do you present your pairings in the best light in terms of serving size, glassware, temperature, those kinds of details. And that's the course.
And I suppose now that the pandemic may be slowing down more, you might have some live events coming up where restaurant owners might be designing menus and having a group of people come, or?
I've done a lot of beer dinners in my day. And at this stage, I'm very much focused on the course. So the one thing that I might be doing, I did do one last year and it went super well, is called a cohort, is the technical term. And what that is that I take a group through the course. So for example, on a Monday, we'll all meet on Zoom and we'll chat, and then they have a whole week to complete section one. And the following Monday, we meet up again, I answer questions, we do activities to sort of strengthen the understanding, help with the synthesis. I mean, the course already comes with quizzes, homework, assignments, handouts, you know, and in everything that I do. And especially because this was a remote learning situation, I wanted to make sure that students had every potential opportunity to strengthen and confirm their knowledge. But with this cohort, we meet once a week. So that increases that accountability of, mm-hmm. I have to finish this section because we're all going to be chatting about it in a week. And it also gives, a deeper opportunity for learning, and it builds that community. So, so that is something that I would like to do again. I just have to see scheduling wise, mm-hmm. When I might be able to pull it off. And that would be a separate offering of the course. So I would say that's the next step for me. And hopefully people who are taking the class as the pandemic eases will be now hosting a bunch of fun beer dinners.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. I was watching your YouTube earlier actually. And one of your videos in particular stuck out to me, and it's probably something that you're going to talk about on the course, which is questioning old beer habits. And I really particularly enjoyed your video on the 3 C's of food pairing. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. So that's a series of 4 videos that I put together. Ooh, when did I do that? Maybe two or 3 years ago. And again, my work with beerology is always trying to move the industry forward. And so these are 4 things I noticed that we're always talking about, and we just assume that's the way things are. And I felt needed to be questioned a little bit. Hence questioning old beer habits. And so there's 4 of the videos, but yes, one of them is the 3 C's, and it's always, I have done extensive research. I can't even figure out where these 3 C's come from. when did that start? I know that to the best of my understanding, 2 of the C's came from, two of the C's came from wine. I think. But I don't know the history. Anyway, long story short, when we talk about the 3 C's, cut, complement, and contrast, we talk about them being 3 different ways to pair beer with food. So you can either have a cut pairing, a complement pairing, or a contrast pairing. And the truth is that you have to have a complement and a contrast in any pairing. And the cut is already built in. So what I argue in that video is that you need all 3 in each pairing. Mm-hmm. From there, yes, you can, and that's all I say in the video. In my course, I then go on to explain how to construct a complement pairing or how to construct a contrast pairing, keeping also the other C's in mind to support that pairing, because a pairing can't be about one element. Right? Mm-hmm. If I just look at one of the flavors in the beer and one of the flavors in the food and pair those 2, it could be very good, but chances are there's a chance it could be a train wreck. So you have to take everything into account, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how many courses in a meal would you recommend? Like 5 small courses, like appetizer, main, dessert with a couple of snacks in between, or what is kind of the sweet spot?
I don't think there is a sweet spot. It depends on the occasion, depends on, the energy of the chef, obviously. I do address this in the course. I think the key thing, obviously, is the more courses you have, the smaller the portions. Mm. And the more courses you have, the more you really have to be careful and mindful of serving size too, mm-hmm. With alcohol. Most of my food pairing work has been, in public events and at restaurants and things like that. And so for me, responsible drinking is always a piece of it, because people have driven to come to the event, and I want them to, mm-hmm. if they want, if they have to drive, be aware of how much they're imbibing. And so that's also, I provide some tools to help with that in the course as well. But in terms of the number of courses, I think there will come a point where your palate will probably be shot and you won't be enjoying the pairings as much. But, I've enjoyed 5-7 course meals, as long as you take it slowly and have little breaks. I don't think there's an ideal number. Okay. Even just 1 pairing is delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose having water available or something to cleanse in between would be really important as well.
Yeah, water is great for sure. A little entremet of some sort. Even like a little fruit beer can be a nice little break. a light fruit beer, just something to change your palate between courses for sure. Mm-hmm. Not so much a fan of the crackers, and that's another one of my old habits videos. If anyone,
I was just gonna make a joke about judging at BJCP competitions where we get the table crackers in between each beer. That's our palate cleanser. Big pack of crackers.
Oh yeah. And
There seems to be a trend that I've noticed here in Ireland anyway, that some of the breweries include on their cans suggested food pairings. Is that something you've seen in Canada?
Not on cans. I've seen it on websites, mm-hmm. but that is really interesting and lovely, I think. Yeah. And, and something I would like to see more of. And that's part of, again, with beer, always trying to move the industry forward and see what's next. And when I started 10 years ago, my big goal was to get craft beer into, get more people excited and drinking craft mm-hmm. beer. Because mm-hmm. when I started, you had to go to those specialty bars, you know, and now we're at the stage where pretty much, I mean, I don't know, I can't speak for Ireland, but in North America, that was the case. And now anywhere you go, there's going to be 1, 2, 3, if not craft beers, you know, at least flavorful, there's going to be an IPA of some sort on draft. So my feeling is, you know, those first years were about, let's get those beers into all of the establishments. And the next phase is, okay, now that we have those beers, let's use them to their maximum potential. And food pairing for me is a big piece of that, because it helps so much with enjoyment and understanding of beer. It's a wonderful customer experience. It, you know, it increases sales. And so that to me is the next step. But I think it's absolutely, I mean, so forward thinking that some of the breweries are already putting it on mm-hmm. their cans mm-hmm. and assuming they're good pairings. Are they good pairings?
Yeah, they're good. They're good pairings. Okay. And I do think a lot of breweries in Ireland are really cognizant of the food element. There's mm-hmm. a lot of, there's been quite a few beer dinners, really fancy, very nice beer dinners, and also a little bit more casual beer dinners. We've done something with, did a couple beer dinners with the Ladies Craft Beer Society of Ireland. And it's definitely something that I think a lot of brewers in Ireland are really wanting to interact with. The concept of this local beer is brewed here, and then we're using the vegetables from the farm down the street, and we're using mm-hmm. This from our friend, you know, who grows this, because mm-hmm. a lot of brewery owners also have a pub. So for example, we did a trip down to see Western Herd at Brewery in Clare, in County Clare, and they also have a pub down there, so it perfectly marries their beer and of course their food, and it just ends up being just a really wonderful all around experience. And I think a lot of breweries do seem passionate about that here, and I think that's mm-hmm. excellent.
yeah I think there's definitely room for brew pubs as the restrictions lift and some of the licensing laws change, and maybe even for festivals and tap takeovers to kind of plan in advance, you know, what beers are going to be there and what foods they have on offer and included in their program.
Yes that's the next level, right?
Yeah. And I will say for like the Ladies Craft Beer Society of Ireland, some of our like most attended or favorited events are like silly beer and food pairings. Like we did like beer and popcorn just for fun, which was great. It was a small local popcorn producer and then a couple of beers, and it was really, really fun and different. And so I kind of also enjoy the beer and food pairings that maybe aren't as expected. I don't know.
Yeah,
I agree.
We did an event. This was, oh yeah, for sure. We did an event. This was a number of years ago, and we just to be silly, we scheduled it on Halloween, but it was a beer and insect pairing. So we cooked crickets, and I mean, nice. Insects are a sustainable mm-hmm. source of protein, mm-hmm. and I've always been an advocate for that. So we had like a little cricket farm, and we had a cricket farmer explaining how it's done and the value of the proteins and insects. And then we had a chef prepare the insects in a various different ways and paired beard with that. So it's also, I think, a lovely, lovely opportunity to educate and to introduce people to new things. I also ran a beer and opera pairing event.
Ooh, love that.
So my general feeling is if you include beer, you're going to attract a certain number of people, and they'll come, you know, like most of the people who went to that, if I ran it 4 years in a row, it was called Hopra. And I would say 70% of the people who came to the event had never listened to opera before and were just there for the beer and because they were intrigued. And a number of them, you know, had a bit of an aha moment of like, wait, opera isn't as what I thought it was, you know?
Sure,
and then,
then
we had a few people who were just into opera and intrigued by the event and enjoyed the beer. And then there was that small sliver, which I'm a part of people who enjoyed both beer and opera and who had like the time of their life, because it was a pretty fun event.
It sounds right up Lisa Grimm's husband, Chris's alley. We'll have to tell him about that, because he loves opera. No, that just sounds really cool. I love the idea of especially unexpected pairings with beer, getting people from two different worlds actually involved. So, you know, you get the beer geeks that now are interested in opera, and the opera lovers now possibly interested in beer. And yeah, I think that's just really cool.
No, Christina, I think you and I love Halloween more than anyone I know. And I believe before I found the society, you did a pairing with Halloween candy and beer.
Yes. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Oh yeah, Halloween candy goes really well with beer, but you know, anything Halloween goes really well with beer. So. Sorry, Marilla, what were you saying?
Well, now I've just thought of something else, which is I used to do a podcast with the Ontario Craft Brewers, and we did for October 1 year do a beer and candy pairing. And it was so myself, who I might have been a master cicerone at the time, I might not, and two brewmasters, and we were, you know, earnestly tasting beers with different candies and really breaking it down. And I remember just having this moment as we were all three doing this and just thinking, this is so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. But like we, you know, the truth is it does pair spectacularly. Mm-hmm. You're right, Christina. But you know, to have like these three of us like so concentrated and like genuinely breaking down these pairings. And it was just, those are, I agree. Some of the most beautiful moments in beer, because beer is an everyday beverage. And so I find those moments really serve to remind us that, you know, it doesn't need to be fancy. Yes. It needs to be appreciated and understood, but it's still beer. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And I love the nostalgia of it. Like, as someone who used to love going trick or treating, like taking candy corn and pairing it with like a lawnmower beer was just so whimsical. Like, it was just so fun to just kind of bring all those things in and to have all these really interesting pairings and be able to have this experience, but also it's just fun. Like, it's just fun.
Yeah.
I think is just wonderful. Yeah.
And it really gets conversations going. Yeah. Yeah. And I almost never eat meat, but when I heard about the chicken wing and beer pairing, I said like, I would probably try that at least once. So my goal is to get lots of Girl Scout cookies in my suitcase the next time I'm in the US and bring them over here, and we can have fun with that and beer. So
nice. Have you gotten into the insects, Erica?
I've tried like sour cream and onion crickets on their own, and I've had some like lollipops that have some type of bug in them, but I haven't ever thought to have them with beer, so we might have to try that.
Yeah, you can also get flour, you know, the ground, I think it's ground crickets. Sure. And it's an excellent source of protein and super, I mean, I don't know your reasons for being vegetarian, but it's super sustainable.
Yeah.
And an excellent source of protein. And it's something I'm vocal about, because people get squicked out with the idea, but it's completely normal in other parts of the world, and something I think we need to embrace more and more as we, you know, realize the dire situation that our planet is in.
Yeah, climate change is not going anywhere, and we need to really, as individuals, do what we can do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, things just took a serious turn.
Oh, I know. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, what happens when you get three women together?
Yeah. Why don't we lighten the mood? And if you have any favorite breweries or beers or styles that you want to give a shout out to, you might just list some of those.
I actually is as part of my mandate with Beerology, and for the past 10 years, I have never named a brewery or a specific beer.
That's fair
enough. And that's just how I roll with Beerology. Mm-hmm. I did, well, first of all, let me just generally answer your question and say that I'm not sure what the weather is like out where the two of you are, but it is in the negative, it is in the negative 15, negative 20 zone over here, and we have a good 2 feet of snow, and I just need amber ales all the time. I need amber ales. I don't know, for some reason porters and stouts, they're not round and luscious enough to give me that round feeling that I need. And I've become quite obsessed over the pandemic. One of my comfort foods has been pizza. So I make a pizza with four cheeses, with like a mozzarella, a sharp cheddar, a blue cheese, and like a provolone, and then I pair that with that amber ale, and it just gives me that moment that I need these days. But otherwise, you know, I've been very much occasion led in terms of the kinds of, you know, I'd love my pilsners in the summer, and my when I'm out with friends, I'm usually drinking IPA. It just depends on the mood. And I find that, like, and this is something that people who have read my book may have read between the lines a little bit, but to me, like, there is a mood connection with beers, you know, like when I'm feeling really mellow, I don't want an IPA, you know, or when I'm feeling very energetic, you know, I don't want an imperial stout.
Sure.
So it's just the way it is. There was something I wanted to use this platform though to talk about, maybe not so much a lighter note, but a bit of a lighter note. And especially because this is an Irish podcast, because I've been on a bit of a crusade for the past 10 years. So I want to enlist both yours and your listeners' support. Mm-hmm. And it started just over 10 years ago when I discovered St. Bridget.
Yeah,
of Kildare.
That's right.
And how awesome she was. And I read so much about her, and I mean, her strong connection with beer, and her, you know, multiplication of the beer, and her turning her bathwater into beer. And so since that day, every year on St. Bridget's Day, which is February 1st, I campaign for a day to celebrate women working in beer. I really feel that we need a day to celebrate women, and St. Bridget is like the perfect original, you know, person to turn to for that. So I just want to take a moment. I mean, February 1st is past, but no, maybe next year, something to think about on February 1st, because there's a lot of women brewing beer, a lot of women in the industry, and they should be celebrated and uplifted. And I feel like that's the day to do it.
I'm going to join you on that. St. Bridget, well, of course, I'm writing the book on the history of beer in Ireland. And my first chapter begins with Bridget. Well, a lot of it's just about Bridget, whether she's real or not. But her story is really important, and her many stories are really important to learning about monastic brewing in the medieval period, and just about importance of women in brewing in general. Because of course, her and St. Patrick are two of the most important saints in Ireland, if not the most important saints in Ireland. And hopefully, we now are going to have Bridget's Day as a national holiday over here. So that's great for us.
Nice. Yeah.
And actually, in her honor this year on Bridget's Day, I did brew a medieval small ale, which I'm turning into a braggot.
Sweet.
So that's happening.
So are you saying there's a chance that, St. Bridget didn't exist?
Oh yeah. So like the she's possibly a juxtaposition of different women. So the first sort of resource we have about St. Bridget was written about 100, 150 years after she was reported to have lived. So by Cogistus in about 650, and she's in the 500s. So whether she was real or not is debatable by historians. Some historians would say that her existence is not necessarily supported, because the reason that she was written about has a lot of political implications within the early medieval Irish church, and sort of a power play of whose church and whose area was more important, of course, because she founded the Church of Kildare, which is the Church of the Oak, which was in direct competition with other churches. So there's some arguments about whether she's historically true or not, but the reality is whether she is or not, people thought she was. Mm-hmm. And that is so important, because her myths are repeated over and over and over again. And it's the same with St. Patrick. So in the course of writing this book, for example, to go off on a little quick tangent, and then I promise I'll rein myself in on this. But so for example, for St. Patrick, in the early 1930s, the 1920s, Ireland, the government of Ireland went around to different schools and had children interview older people. So gentlemen and women in their 80s, 70s, and talk about folk stories that they heard. And the amount of stories that I find about these older folks recalling about like St. Patrick and all these old saints that have to do with beer, the saints brewing beer, miraculous ale wives, and these sorts of things that are well into the 1930s is interesting and important. So even if these people did or did not exist, their folklore continued for centuries and millennia. And I think that is so important. And so them being real is less important.
And I believe the last couple of years I've seen in the Irish newspapers several articles around Bridget's Day, and kids in schools make reeds, reed crosses to honor her. And this year several of the buildings around Dublin lit up to memorialize St. Bridget. So I think there's a lot more awareness. And with that day comes the first day of spring here. It's not on the equinox like it might be in other countries. So there's a lot of like light and energy involved. And I think it is a nice myth that a lot of people still do believe.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful that it's the first day of spring too. Springtime, it's February. What are you talking about? Spring.
I'm looking outside right now, and I can tell you it's not spring over here. As long as she has a day, I'm going to continue to campaign.
Yeah,
I haven't had much traction yet, but I really think it would be a lovely thing if internationally St. Mm-hmm. Bridget's Day was a day to celebrate women and beer. Yeah. And I've been posting about it every year for 10 years, and I've gotten some traction with like a few radio segments, but the quest continues, and I hope you will support me in this quest, because I think it's worthwhile.
Definitely.
And I would just like to say, I was very impressed with the testimonials on your mm-hmm. website with your work as a consultant. And if you would like to give the handles for any Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, we would love to share them in our show notes, if that's okay.
Yeah, for sure. I've managed to be at Beerology everywhere, which I'm pretty proud of. That was no mean feat. It took quite a while to organize, but I'm not on social media very much, but mm-hmm. if you are very interested in beer trivia and what's going on in beer and the latest in beer, both my Twitter and my Facebook are very much focused on interesting things going on mm-hmm. in the beer world. And it's also a place where you can, I'll post if I'm ever doing something new. I'm also on Instagram, where I'm a little bit less active, again, as Beerology. My website is beerology.ca. And then my course is beerology.thinkific.com. Mm-hmm. And there's also a Mastering Beer and Food Pairing brought to you by Beerology Facebook page.
Perfect.
But I'm pretty sure if I did my job right, again, not the best self-promoter, but if, I would hope that if you go to any of my social media handles, you could find my course through there. Fingers crossed.
And we'll share the course and all the details in our show notes and on our social media. So anyone who's listening, you can just click along and get right to it. So we'll wrap up there. And I just want to say thank you so much, Marella, for coming on. We learned so much. Your course sounds amazing. Just like a wonderful course for people who have some knowledge of beer and just want to just take it to that next level with food pairings. It sounds so, so interesting. So thank you for coming on and sharing that with us today.
Thanks. Thank you very much. I've gotten great feedback on the course and I'm excited about more people taking it and hopefully more food pairing happening. That'd be wonderful.
Oh yeah.
Thank you both. This has been
lovely. Thank you. All right. Cheers.
So goodbye.
Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.